We are talking once again with Joff Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good day.
Hey, good afternoon.
Good day, mate.
I was trying to come up with a variation on good afternoon, good morning, good evening. Starting with local and the final week of massaging the city budget. Mm-hmm.
Yes. So on Thursday and Friday, the city council was scheduled to vote on the budget balancing package, and they managed to take care of most of their business on Thursday, including looking at options to pull out any amendments, individual amendments in the package for individual discussion, you know, making changes and taking separate votes. The amendments were actually presented to the Council Budget Committee in four groups. Group A contained the vast majority of the amendments, 156 amendments that were expected to be pretty non-controversial and to pass unanimously. Group B, and they did, and Group B had 30 amendments that were substantially revised after the balancing package was released on November 10th. These were also expected to be non-controversial and to pass unanimously, but they were pulled out as a separate deal so that the city council, in case anyone member or members had questions about any of them, they could discuss and make changes to them. But those passed pretty quickly. Group C was 11 new amendments introduced after the balancing package was released. These amendments have to be self-balancing. They have to have a revenue source identified as well as an expenditure. The most notable of these was Lisa Herbold's amendment to place a cap of $500,000 on Mayor Durkin's executive order to pay hiring bonuses to the Seattle Police Department, in the Seattle Police Department. And the amendment would end that program on December 31st when Durkin's term ends. Tammy Morales also included or introduced an amendment that would spend $900,000 to increase the new community service officer program in the Seattle Police Department. And Group D had five amendments that wanted to use the same funding source, which is the Revenue Stabilization Fund or the city's main reserve fund. Three of these amendments, two were proposed by Alex Peterson and one by Andrew Lewis, would have restored funding that Teresa Mosqueda's balancing package would have cut from the Seattle Police Department. The other two would put money towards a waterfront shuttle service downtown and add staff to the city auditor's budget to increase auditing capacity. In addition, Lorena Gonzalez proposed a new amendment that would change the baseline calculation for the Seattle Police Department's salary to more accurately reflect the number of officers they expect to have on payroll. So this was the amendment that got all of the press this week. Her amendment would have lowered the baseline number of officers that are included in the Seattle Police Department's revenue calculations by about 101 fewer officers. Now, this means that the Seattle Police Department wouldn't have a huge $19 million salary savings slush fund that they could spend on whatever they want. Mayor Durkin's budget acknowledges that the baseline is too high and that there's always going to be this slush fund. She takes that $19 million estimated.
Wait. Always?
Yes.
Like yes. Forever?
Yes. Because, well, at least going forward for the next few years, the Seattle Police Department, this is something the Seattle Police Department has done as a matter of course. They've always had the high baseline salary number. Then they say, well, we're going to try to hire to that level, but we probably won't. So there's this additional amount of money here that's going to be a slush fund we can use on whatever we want. Right. Mayor Durkin's budget acknowledged that there'd be about $19 million that wouldn't be spent out of salary because the Seattle Police Department couldn't hire up to the baseline, to that high baseline number. And then she allocated it to other things like paying hiring bonuses and a bunch of new programs within SPD, like really vague technology projects that weren't explained to the council until the last minute, you know, and new equipment purchases and travel and things like that. But instead, Lorena Gonzalez said, well, why do we always have that high baseline number? Let's reset the baseline at where we expect, where the Seattle Police Department estimates expect that they will be able to hire next year. Right? Makes sense, right? But that's when Chief Diaz flew off the handle and wrote and released his big memo to the press as well as to the city council saying, oh, my God, the city council is cutting the number of officers on the force by 101 next year.
They're profiling crime.
Yeah, which is absolutely not true. Then local media jumped on the bandwagon, describing the amendment as a move to cut 101 officers from the payroll, which is not what it was. Instead, the proposed cut, as I said, assumes that the Seattle Police Department wouldn't reach its hiring targets again this coming year, as it hasn't in the past, and that attrition will be higher than the Seattle Police Department is predicting again this year, as it has in the past, and that's what that amendment would have done. But of course, a majority of the council then chickened out and voted to retain the higher salary baseline in Mayor Durkan's budget on a 5-4 vote. And the five who voted to keep the baseline salary budget intact were Lisa Herbold, Deborah Juarez, Andrew Lewis, Alex Peterson, and Dan Strauss. The four who voted for Gonzalez's amendment were Lorena Gonzalez, Tammy Morales, Teresa Mosqueda, and Shama Sawant. Now, in voting to keep the higher baseline number, both Lisa Herbold and Andrew Lewis said that they didn't want to set a lower target for hiring for the Seattle Police Department, leaving that baseline number or the top target for the number of officers at SPD as something that the police chief should set and not something that the city council should set. So essentially, they sort of caved on the budget by saying, well, you know, reality doesn't really matter. What matters is what the police chief thinks is the goal in terms of the number of officers that the force should have in Seattle. So I think they were less worried in terms of the budget than they were in terms of the potential for Mayor Durkan to veto the entire budget over the single amendment, and that they were worried that they might be working on a revised budget into December when they have other legislation that they want to tackle while Lorena Gonzalez is still on the council and before Sarah Nelson takes office. That's what I think was really behind that. It wasn't just a public perception thing. I think it was, do we hold up the budget? Do we end up working on this thing through December, or do we just kind of give in this year and maybe revisit it later? I think there's a lot of potential there for the city council to come back in the middle of next year and say, once again, SPD, you didn't hit your hiring targets. Maybe it's time to reset the baseline, or we want to claw back that salary savings. If the Seattle Police Department hasn't already allocated and spent it like they did this past year. Mm-hmm. Okay. So then the council.
What did they spend it on?
Oh, a number of different things, including, you know, technology, quote unquote, technology projects that, you know, the council had not heard anything about in the prior year. But mostly I think they like to have that extra amount in salary because then they like to turn around and go, well, you know, we paid overtime. Once again, we paid overtime that we didn't tell you about. And we don't have eyes on who received that money and how much overtime because we don't have in spite of all of our, you know, vague technology projects, we don't yet have a finished electronic form of tracking our employees' hours. It's all still on paper slips. Okay. And
my impression is Seattle Police Department is the only entity in City of Seattle that actually has structured a slush fund arrangement like this?
Yes. There's no other department in the city government that has a salary baseline that is unrealistic like that. The Seattle Police Department is the only department that has that. And that was Lorena Gonzalez's point. She says, look, let's just make it like every other department in the city. We pay you the salary for the officers you have, you know, not the salary for the officers that you dream you may have one day. And if you hire more, great. We allocate more money for you in the middle of next year, you know, if it looks like you've spent more than half your budget. But nope, that's not what happened. So then the council went on to vote down the three amendments by Alex Peterson and Andrew Lewis that would have restored cuts to the SPD's budget. So Mosqueda's balancing package retained cuts of about $10 million to Durkin's budget for the Seattle Police Department, cutting it by about 3% from her increased budget. But the Seattle Police Department will still see an increase over 2021's budget. Okay, so no net decrease for them year over year. The council will, as I said, will almost certainly review the budget again in the middle of the next year. And if the Seattle Police Department is not meeting its hiring targets, then a proposal to change the baseline salary number may come up again. And as I said, they will almost certainly want to claw back some of the salary savings if they can.
Yeah, but they'll have a different configuration of people in by then. So
true. Very true. Now, the council voted to pass the main Group A and B packages. They'll meet on Monday morning to pass the full budget out of committee, you know, discuss any remaining amendments that require votes. And then they'll meet as the full council in the afternoon to take a final vote. Then the budget will go to Mayor Durkin for her signature. So that's the status of the budget.
Well, another stellar article this week from Carolyn Bick in the South Seattle Emerald.
Oh, yeah. She's been looking, taking a pretty hard look at Seattle's oversight bodies for the Seattle Police Department, in particular the Office of the Inspector General of the Seattle Police Department. She's continued to write about problems at the Office of Inspector General. She's written a couple of articles about this topic, the most recent one this week entitled Auditor Under Investigation Continued to Certify Cases After OIG Became Aware of Problems. Okay, so the OIG is tasked with reviewing the cases that are heard by the Office of Police Accountability and either signing off on those cases or disagreeing with them. Now, they serve a really key oversight function of the OPA, right? So you have the OPA hears cases hears complaints against the SPD for use of force cases and policy complaints and things like that. The OPA reviews the evidence, you know, they'll interview the person who complained, they'll interview the officers involved, they'll look at body-worn video camera recordings, they'll look at any other evidence that is in front of them, including reports that were taken at the time and interviews that they do afterwards. They'll talk to, you know, an officer's supervisors and so forth. They put together these reports into a case file, right? The OIG then, the OPA will, you know, review the case and then they come out with a report of their findings, whether or not a complaint should be sustained against an officer and recommend discipline in that case. Or more often, they'll come out with a ruling that says there's no problem here, right? The officer was following his training or it was unclear what happened, so we can't make a ruling. That tends to be more commonly what they say. And then the case goes over to the OIG, the Office of Inspector General, right? And then someone at the OIG, one of the auditors at the OIG is supposed to review all of the evidence in the case, not just one piece or the report issued, the summary report issued by the OPA. They're supposed to look at all the evidence, and then they're supposed to determine whether the OPA did a good job or not, whether they can support what ruling the OPA gave, right?
And it is really telling that an oversight body for SPD itself needs an oversight body.
Yeah, exactly.
That's screwed up.
Now, yeah, but it's important because we're finding out now that the OIG isn't really fulfilling its oversight function of the OPA. After people have begun complaining too that the OPA is not fulfilling its oversight function of the SPD, right? Now, BIC is reporting that there's an auditor at the OIG that has been signing off on OPA cases without fully reviewing them first, sometimes taking just a few minutes to open a single case file, to open the case file, maybe open a single report, maybe not even opening the case file, and then simply rubber stamping the OPA's work. The auditor is Anthony Fennell, and he's been under investigation for several weeks after other OIG staff complained multiple times to OIG Inspector General Lisa Judge and Deputy Inspector General Amy Tsai. Fennell is a former police officer. He served with the Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department for 23 years. Now, while he's been under investigation by an unnamed third party, Fennell has continued to audit OPA cases. So even though there's been this complaint that Fennell isn't doing his job, he's still on the job. The Community Police Commission has expressed concern about Fennell's performance or non-performance of his job and the ensuing investigation, but they've not released the contents of their letters to the judge and Tsai at the OIG. The South Seattle Emerald has put in a public disclosure request to get the contents of those letters. So the Community Police Commission, which is supposed to, the third oversight body, which is supposed to perform a role of as liaison with the community, but also to inform policies of the OPA, the Seattle Police Department, and the OIG, is the outside body that can then sort of raise issues of how come the whole process is not working, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that appears to be what's going on right now. You know, here's a big issue within the OIG, and the Community Police Commission is raising some concerns about it, but the concerns that they've raised and the actual letters that they've sent to the OIG are not public yet.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that's what I find very interesting about all this is the Community Police Commission is supposed to be the liaison with the public, right? And their meetings and their communication should be completely public, that there are these letters back and forth between the CVC and the OIG. Over this one auditor have not been made public. I find that very interesting. But hopefully the Emerald will get the contents of those letters soon and we'll be able to see.
Well, according to a post by Carolyn Bick yesterday, mm-hmm. She's expecting several months to transfer.
Yeah, we'll see.
Hands on that.
Because yeah. That's typical with a public disclosure request is that it can take weeks, if not months, to be.
Well, it's particularly true with any kind of public disclosure request that SPD gets.
Yeah.
We'll walk them. I speak from personal experience on that. So, yeah.
Yeah. So we'll see. Now, BIC's initial story in the Emerald was published on November 8th, and it's entitled OIG Auditor Certified Cases Without Reviewing Evidence Investigation Reveals. Her updated story is dated November 18th. So if you want to read more about that, I would suggest you go back and read the November 8th story, because it will give you the details of what the issues are with that particular auditor and why he's under investigation. I think that's a good place to start. And then, of course, her article on the 18th.
And really, you should read everything that Carolyn posts because she is the best City Hall reporter in town right now. Mm-hmm. She really is.
Yeah, and she appears to be doing the bulk of the investigations currently into what's happening with the police department that none of the three agencies tasked with oversight of them are doing, you know?
Yeah. Well, the CPC
she and Paul Kiefer, if I'm pronouncing his last name right, at Publicola are, I think, the two best on issues related to public safety in Seattle. So if you want to kind of keep track of what's going on there, I would keep reading those two, because you're not going to find a lot of this stuff in the Seattle Times, unfortunately.
No, Seattle Times appears to be getting their leads from those two people. So, again. Yeah.
Well, the Seattle Times seems to take their stories from whatever press release is issued by Interim Chief Diaz and Mayor Durkin.
Yeah, they also believe in the trickle-up theory, apparently, that you have spoken about in the past. Where
the bubbling up versus trickling down.
Yeah.
That great stories start at the grassroots and then they kind of bubble up to the mainstream press when enough heat's applied.
Yes. So, moving on, a new survey out this week?
Yeah, the Northwest Progressive Institute did a survey with the Seattle Neighborhood Greenways. The two groups together, they asked Seattle residents three questions about what the city should change in the future regarding transportation and streets. This all kind of came as part of a look at how streets should be used during the COVID-19 pandemic and afterwards, what changes were made during the COVID-19 pandemic lockdown that people would like to see continue into the future. And I think it's really important right now, after the city council has included money in the 2022 budget to combine all of the various master transportation plans, for example, the pedestrian master plan, the transit master plan, the bicycle master plan, the freight mobility plan, et cetera, all into one big transportation plan for Seattle. It's worthwhile right now to be asking the question of which of those do Seattle residents really value? Right. So the first question asked about values, and the ones that rose to the top are at the very top is safety. 96% of respondents said that they thought that was the most important topic, the most important value for the city in terms of transportation. Number two was accessibility, including options for people who are elderly or disabled to get around the city. And I know that's something that you're big about too, Mike, is making sure that, for example, sidewalks don't have obstacles in them for people with wheelchairs or who are sight impaired or have trouble getting around.
Yeah, you probably heard me yelling all the way over there where you live.
Yeah. Number three, and that was actually 94% of respondents said accessibility was a top priority. Number three is affordability, so that residents who are lower income can have an affordable transportation option to get to jobs, to get to healthcare, to get their healthcare needs taken care of, to get to the store, to get their kids to school, etc. Number four was convenience. 91% said that transportation options need to be convenient, right? Number five was kid-friendly streets. Streets should be safe so that kids can get around on their own to school, to their friends' houses, to get to places that they need to go. Racial equity was number six with 88%. Clean environment was number seven with 88%. And then the two bringing up the bottom in terms of values were health. Building exercise into transportation options, 82% felt that was important, and happiness. So 73%, almost three out of four, said that that getting around town should be enjoyable. It shouldn't just be sitting in your car and fuming because you're stuck at a stoplight, right? Or it shouldn't be, you know, every time you turn down a street, there's construction. You know, it should be an enjoyable way to, there should be an enjoyable way to get around. And, you know, if we live in the United States, right, you know, the pursuit of happiness is supposed to be important, right? Right? So transportation should be somewhat enjoyable rather than something that you, that you hate. Okay. Then they asked what people would be willing to do in their own neighborhoods, even if it meant giving up a lane of traffic. Okay, and this was really important. There were five items that rose to the top of the list. One, number one was have safe walking and biking routes to schools. That got 84% of respondents.
And bear in mind that that there are not sidewalks in significant parts of Seattle still.
Yeah, north end and south end of the city completely lacks sidewalks. So that is a big issue for people who don't live in the core of the city. Number two was more space for outdoor dining and outdoor retail, particularly in response to COVID-19. Okay, so 84% said that that was very important and that they would be willing to give up a lane of traffic for that. Number three on the list was wider sidewalks and planting strips. Again, that points to that accessibility issue, which was number two on the list of values, that the sidewalks be wide enough so that people are not always encountering barriers when they're trying to just walk down the street or ride down the street if they're in a wheelchair, for example. Number four was dedicated bus lanes. 74% said that they were willing to give up a lane of traffic to create a dedicated bus lane. That's three out of four respondents. Okay, so that shows you the importance of transit to Seattle residents. And number five on the list, and this might be a surprise, is 71% said that they would give up a bus lane. They would give up a lane of traffic for dedicated, separated bike lanes. Okay.
Good.
So so city politicians keep saying, oh, you know, maybe 10% of Seattleites ever get on a bicycle, right? Well, I think this survey shows you that there are many, many more Seattleites who would love to get on a bicycle if they felt safe to do it.
Yeah.
And that they just don't with our current transportation system. Okay. And then the third question was about what changes people would support in order for the city to meet its goals for greenhouse gas reductions, racial equity, economic growth, health and safety, livability. Okay. So Seattle has a lot of pretty ambitious goals to meet those things. To meet those things, what changes would people support for that, right? And here's the four items that rose to the top. First, number one is the 15-minute walkable city was supported by 81% of respondents. And that includes providing a mix of housing, retail, and amenities within a 15-minute walk of your home. Not a 15-minute car ride, but a 15-minute walk of your home. So that really speaks to the idea of there should be retail spread out throughout the city. There should be a mix of affordable housing, as well as market rate housing out in neighborhoods. And there should be various amenities as well spread throughout the city so that not everyone has to get in a car, go to the mall, or get on a bus, go downtown to get what they need, right?
Or travel across town to get your booster shot, you know? You
should be exactly, yeah. Number two on the list was closing streets to create walkable shopping streets, like at Pike Place Market, for example. 81% supported that. So that's interesting. You know, again, that's something, that's an amenity we go downtown to enjoy is Pike Place Market. There are many, many people who think, yeah, we should be doing that in the neighborhoods too. We should have at least one or two streets that we close so that people have a walkable shopping district, right? That where they don't have to compete with cars.
And bear in mind, this was part of the urban village, urban planning concept that was put forward in the early 90s, and it still hasn't been realized in a lot of neighborhoods.
Yeah. Number three on the list was shifting traffic enforcement from the Seattle Police Department to the Seattle Department of Transportation to free up the police to do important work. And that was 73% of respondents. Again, almost three out of four people acknowledging that it's crazy for a guy with a gun or a woman with a gun and a badge to be issuing parking tickets or traffic violations, right? That should be SDOT. And then number four on the list was traffic calming and closing certain neighborhood streets for deliveries only so people can safely walk, run, bike, and play. Okay, so that's 67%, or two out of every three people said that they felt it was important to have greenways or streets that were with limited or no vehicle traffic so that people in the neighborhood don't necessarily go there to shop, but go there to just exercise or to use them as a way to get from point A to point B without having to dodge automobile traffic. So that's the results of the survey. And I think what it really shows is that Seattleites widely support initiative that would get us out of our cars and make our lives more neighborhood centric and instead of commuter centric. Okay. And that's one thing we need to take away, I think, from the pandemic lockdown is that people feel more centered to their neighborhoods now and less like they're part of a big city that just kind of, that you have to get in a car to get somewhere or get on a bus to get somewhere.
And perhaps the whole concept of the downtown core that was big in this last election, you know, maybe that's finally being recognized as being outdated.
Yeah, we'll see. This idea that the economic heart of the city has to be the downtown, has to be the downtown core.
Yeah, and in terms of urban planning, that has not been true for at least 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, take a look at downtown Bellevue. That didn't exist 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But it's changed. And how Americans move around is changing.
Mm-hmm.
And how they're going to move around, you know, 30 years from now, given climate change, has to be planned for.
Yeah. So I thought this was a very important survey, just to show when people try to imagine the perfect city, and the perfect transportation system, what they desire.
All right. Mm-hmm. Well, there is a district in Seattle this week that received new ballots to vote again.
Yes, yeah. For residents of District 3, there's one more opportunity to vote this year, and that's the Shamasawant recall vote. Ballots have already been mailed out, and if you live in District 3, are a registered voter, and you haven't received your ballot by Monday, you should call King County Elections at 206-296-8683. District 3, again, includes Capitol Hill, First Hill, and North Beacon Hill. Okay. You probably know if you're in District 3. And, of course, if you have received your ballot, you need to mark your ballot and mail them in by Election Day on December 7th. And Shama's survived multiple tough re-elections. We are hoping that she survives this vote as well, but it's going to hinge on the ability of her supporters to get out the vote against a big money campaign to unseat her. So if you live in District 3, mark your ballot, remind your friends and neighbors to vote as well. And if you have not registered, you can still register to vote online by November 29th at voter.votewa, that's VOTEWA, .gov.
And again, it's from the same people that funded the other pro-chamber campaigns here in Seattle. A lot of familiar faces that threw money to
we've covered this in the past, but a lot of big real estate PACs and big real estate money has gone into the campaign to try to unseat her.
Yeah. So, and you know, another $130,000 was dropped yesterday. So,
yeah, they're working as hard as they can to try to boot her out off the city council.
And I can explain that.
Yeah.
She's made a cornerstone of her time in office to try and rein in abusive landlords. And as one thing real estate executives love, it's abusive landlords.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and add into that her support for the Carpenters Union, which definitely would affect the bottom line for a lot of real estate developers if they had to pay more in wages and benefits to their carpenters. And so on.
And they specifically pushed for the election to happen, you know, in the
in December. Not in November, along with the other things that everyone voted on in November.
Which the Sawant campaign wanted because they know that higher turnout benefits them.
So they're counting on people not turning out. So perhaps that might be incentive right there.
So again, get your ballots if you're in District 3 back by Pearl Harbor Day.
December 7th.
Yes, it's the 80th anniversary of Pearl Harbor this year. Mm-hmm. Woohoo.
All right. Okay. Anything else on that?
Nope.
Well, then let's dive into this week's COVID-related news.
Oh, dear. Okay. Well, locally and nationally, case numbers are starting to climb. And this is not a surprise. The TSA is estimating that airline travel this coming week for the Thanksgiving holiday will be at or higher than 2019 levels. So, you know, if the numbers are already starting to climb, particularly in northern tier states, that is states where winter weather has already onset, not the Sun Belt. So states like North Dakota, Minnesota, Colorado, Wisconsin, Michigan, Vermont, and New Hampshire have the highest new case rate in the country right now. And that's pretty much regardless of vaccination rate. Vermont, for example, has the highest vaccination rate of any state, and they were one of the two highest case rates in the country this past week. So that's a concern. We had a very important development yesterday where a key CDC panel recommended approval of booster shots for the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines for all people age 18 plus in the United States. We've seen a number of studies around the world where this has already been enacted, that those booster shots are highly effective, can provide protection for up to 10 months, and are well worth pursuing. So hopefully the full CDC is going to approve that. The FDA has already approved it by early next week, and states can begin rolling out booster shots to anybody who wants them. Now, of course, there's still a significant portion of the population that hasn't been vaccinated at all, and they are the main vector right now for new cases. As we move into the holidays, be very, very careful of your obnoxious Thanksgiving uncle who holds forth about right-wing conspiracies at the dinner table, because he's probably not vaccinated either, and he may be endangering the whole family.
Almost certainly endangering himself, because he's probably older and a male, and as we know, unvaccinated men are the ones who are most likely to be hospitalized, put on a ventilator, and eventually perish from COVID-19.
Yeah. And,
unfortunately,
if you want to see what's going to happen this winter, take a look at Europe, which, of course, has already been having winter weather for the last 6 weeks or so. They now account for over half the new cases in the world. Particularly Eastern Europe, where vaccination rates are low, have some of the highest new case rates and highest hospitalization rates and highest death rates in the world. And Russia has been particularly bad in this regard, but a number of other countries, Ukraine, Poland, and increasingly Germany as well, you know, they're looking at very high new case rates and very high mortality rates, even though they have an excellent healthcare system and, you know, relatively high vaccination rates. But if you have 85% vaccination, that still means 15% of your population can spread it easily. And what we know now about the Delta variant, which has been around for a few months, is that so-called herd immunity, it was originally thought that you reach some sort of herd immunity, which is to say enough people are vaccinated that the disease cannot spread easily. That 70% vaccination was the benchmark that a lot of people were using. Well, with Delta, it's more like 90 to 95% vaccination rates are necessary to prevent spread of it. And obviously, that's nobody not a, has that kind of level.
Yeah, and that's not a
the U.S.
That's not a big surprise, and shouldn't come as a big surprise, because that's true for a lot of other viruses that you need well over 90%, closer to 95% in order to get true herd immunity. An example would be whooping cough.
Yeah, which is extremely contagious, which is why people get alarmed when there are outbreaks of whooping cough. But, the holidays are going to be a treacherous time for COVID-19. The pandemic is not over. And, continue to wear masks in public, particularly in indoor spaces, regardless of your vaccination status, regardless of whether you've had a booster shot. You can still spread the virus. Please don't. And please protect yourself and loved ones this holiday season.
Yeah, and I went out to the theater for the first time this week in, God, easily over a year, pretty much since the pandemic started. And they definitely check that you have been vaccinated now. So you want to make sure to have that documentation with you if you
plan. Yeah, also any restaurant should be checking your vaccination status as well. Mm-hmm. And most do at this point. From what I can tell, compliance for that in Seattle is quite good. Mm-hmm. Okay. I don't know about the rest of the state, though.
Yeah, and I think if you just go one county north and one county south, you might find vaccination rates are a little different than they are here in King County. So, again, choose your destination wisely. And maybe check with your relatives to make sure that they've all been vaccinated before you gather together at a big event with
Uncle
everyone
Bob,
in the,
you're going to have to sit
in the same room.
Table.
Yeah, Uncle Bob might need to sit out on the back porch with a mask on.
He can watch a football game while the rest of you eat.
Yeah.
It's what he wanted to do anyway.
Right.
Finally got his wish.
Yep.
All right. Well, let's move on then to national news and the verdict on the Rittenhouse case came down yesterday.
Yeah, and it wasn't a surprise for anybody who's been following the trial. And, you know, there's a remarkable amount of stupid involved in this whole tragedy. One of the things I want to focus on is, nobody's talking about Kyle Rittenhouse's mother. I mean, she knows that her, shall we say, emotionally undeveloped young man, her son, is not fully emotionally or physically mature. I mean, Rittenhouse is only 5'3". He can't shave yet. He's still a kid. And she drove him to Kenosha across a state line with an AR-15. She knew what he wanted to do. And why she thought this was a good idea and why she does not have criminal culpability is beyond me. But there was a lot of stupid that went into this tragedy on all sides, to be fair. And again, there's enough there to introduce reasonable doubt about self-defense. We're seeing wild celebrations on the far right, and particularly today I just got a tweet that the Proud Boys are marching in Manhattan, and they're marching in Milwaukee, and this is something that on right-wing message boards last night, people were celebrating as open season on quote-unquote rioters. which, again, there were a number of questionable decisions and assertions by the judge in this case. The only thing that the verdict can be appealed on is the actual trial record. And it's not at all clear that any of the judge's eccentricities are grounds for appeal. It doesn't sound like the state wants to appeal the verdict anyway. They just put the circus behind them. But it's a very concerning verdict, only for the precedent that it sets. And, of course, that's not what a trial concerns itself with. They don't care about the larger political landscape or what impact a verdict might have on the larger political landscape. They're wrestling with the facts of the case, and every case is different. I want to talk a little bit about, you know, could we see a Rittenhouse type situation happen in Seattle? And, you know, every case is a little bit different, but the answer, short answer to that is it already has. It happened in 2016. And both of you will remember this. This was around the time of Donald Trump's election when we had a shooting on the UW campus.
Yes,
at an event by right-wing provocateur Milo Yiannopoulos. And, you know, that particular case, we had a right-wing vigilante shooting a left-wing protester. A nonviolent left-wing protester at a, you know, emotionally charged setting where police were making no effort to intervene or to separate the two sides or to arrest the shooter once the incident happened. The shooter had to turn themselves in, and then that turned out to be, a red herring a couple days later. So what happened was a young man named, he's not that young, he was, I think, 34 at the time, Joshua Dukes, was acting as a peacekeeper for anti-fascist protests, because Yiannopoulos had a long track record of inflammatory statements. It really was how he was making his living at the time. And eventually those statements caught up with him, and he became too controversial, even for right-wing trolls. But at the time, he was a hot ticket. The event was sold out, so there were people still milling around outside after the event had started, on both sides. And, you know, what happened was that you had a guy named Mark Hokuana who was trying to pick fights. He was a Trump supporter, a very vocal Trump supporter, trying to pick fights with some of the anti-fascist protesters. Picked a fight. A peacekeeper named Joshua Dukes tried to intervene and was shot for his efforts. Now, it turned out that Mark Hokuana was not the shooter, as video footage revealed. His wife, Elizabeth, was. He turned himself in as the shooter a couple days later to try and protect her. But she eventually was the shooter. They were both eventually charged. But those charges were dropped. The reason they were dropped, at least the immediate reason, was that Joshua Dukes, for ideological reasons, did not want to participate in prosecution, didn't want to press charges, didn't want to testify. And King County Attorney Dan Seidelberg felt that without his testimony, you know, the case was not prosecutable. So Elizabeth Hokuana nearly killed Joshua Dukes with a point blank shot to the gut, and never faced any legal accountability for her actions at all. Nor did her husband, the belligerent guy. That happened in Seattle, and it didn't get a lot of national attention because this was in the days immediately after Donald Trump's election, and they were worried about other things like the, you know, impending fall of democracy. But it happened in Seattle. There was no accountability. I should also mention that both Elizabeth Hokuana and Joshua Dukes were white. So that's similar to Kenosha as well. And, you know, the Rittenhouse verdict in the bigger picture, there's a long history of this in the United States criminal justice system of it protecting white supremacists and protecting white supremacists targeting civil rights activists. Of course, almost all of Jim Crow was based on this kind of legal terrorism. You know, everything from, you know, John Brown to the Freedom Summer murders in Philadelphia, Mississippi. You know, again, this is the norm. The Derek Chauvin verdict earlier this year was not the norm. And some of that's gradually changing. But for anybody who followed this verdict, the standard of reasonable doubt is a very high standard to meet in a criminal trial. And I think it was apparent during the trial that the prosecution did not meet this standard. And they I don't think the verdict was a surprise. It's disappointing, of course, because you want to see Rittenhouse face some legal accountability. But it was not a surprise. And Rittenhouse has now become a hero on the far right. You had three congresspeople, three, Paul Gosar, and it's actually kind of predictable which ones, Paul Gosar,
Gates.
Matt Gates, and, who's the other one? They all offered him internships, even though he's not even remotely qualified, for those highly competitive positions. Excuse me. Because he's a hero on the far right. He cannot legally drink yet, but once he can, he will never have to buy a beer for the rest of his life. He says at this point he doesn't want to be a police officer. Now he wants to be a nurse. And, you know, these seem like adolescent fantasies rather than a clearly actualizable plan. But, it was just a very, very sad incident all the way around, and two people lost their lives as a result, and, you know, that can never be undone.
Yeah. Well, and there was another trial going on this week.
Yeah, the Armand Arbery, the trial of Armand Arbery's killers in Brunswick, Georgia, and that trial continues, and I expect with Rittenhouse trial over, that one's going to get more national media attention now. And the three people accused in that case of killing Armand Arbery, who was basically murdered for jogging while black, they're claiming self-defense also, and that Arbery, tried to reach for their weapons. And that's going to be another very highly charged case. Again, there was no close by video of that incident either. So again, reasonable doubt may come into play in that case as well. It's straight up racial profiling and a racially motivated killing. Whether they're legally culpable for it, again, our justice system has white supremacy baked into the recipe for all its other strengths. That is also an objective fact. So don't be surprised at any outcome for that particular trial either.
Other developments this week regarding our justice system?
Yeah, I want to talk about a case in Pennsylvania that has not gotten national media attention at all. That was a December 2020 killing in the small town of Stroudsburg, Pennsylvania, of a young Asian American man named Christian Hall. He was 19 years old. He was suicidal. And police dash cam footage apparently showed him waving a gun in the air when he was shot by multiple state highway patrol officers. Now this again, at minimum is a case where, somebody in mental health crisis should not be confronted by armed police officers, but, he was threatening to kill himself and he was on the ledge of a bridge, I should add at the time. So this was widely, characterized in local media as a suicide by cop, situation, except that a Freedom of Information Act request that came out this week showed that the dash cam video that had been released to the public had been edited, And it was what was edited out of the dash cam footage was that Hall had his hands in the air and was surrendering to police at the time he was shot, which seems like kind of an important fact to edit out of your publicly released dash cam footage. But it, again, in addition to the mental health part of that particular tragedy, it's a good reminder that video footage can be edited too. And just because dash cam footage has been released doesn't mean it's necessarily the whole story. So bear that in mind at your next local police department outreach. And then some good news, at least I think so. Two former Oklahoma police officers were convicted this week of second-degree murder. And bear in mind, this is in Oklahoma. This was for – they used their tasers a total of more than 50 times on an unarmed man in a traffic stop in rural Oklahoma. This was in July 4th, 2019. And they were convicted this week of second-degree murder. So they will be they actually did face legal accountability. And again, as with many such cases that we've talked about over the last year, those prosecutions would not be happening were it not for the BLM protests last summer. That really spotlighted in a national way the problem of law enforcement abuses and law enforcement killings that are not justified, and that police in their reports on such incidences often lie, and that you need to have independent outside investigators to look at pretty much every use of force incident that results in a death.
All right. Well, unfortunately, we don't have enough time to talk about the House infrastructure bill that just passed this week.
I want to mention that still needs to go to the Senate, and if the Senate makes any changes, it will need to go back to the House. So that's still
there are some provisions of it that have already been negotiated with Senate members.
Yes.
I think the most important pieces that have already been negotiated with members of the Senate who probably will sign off on these pieces are the ones that relate to healthcare and education. So, for example,
and,
it contains...
And those are hugely important.
They are hugely important, yeah. It contains extensions of some important premium subsidies for Americans who purchase their health insurance plans through the Affordable Care Act marketplaces, at least for the next 3 years. And again, for low-income people in a dozen states that have not expanded Medicaid, they'll be able to buy ACA health plans without paying a monthly premium for at least the next 3 years. That's going to help at least 4 million people right there. So those are
not controversial. Also expanded the child tax credits beyond the end of the year.
Mm-hmm. And for the first time, it contains the ability for government insurance plans like Medicare to negotiate lower drug prices on about a dozen medications, including medications for people who are undergoing cancer treatment. So that's a historic first right there. And hopefully in the future, they'll be able to expand on that. But it also
And there's plenty of cable TV ads right now, which are being bankrolled by pharmaceutical trade groups how awful that is. That, you know, government shouldn't be interfering in a free market. Well, when the free market is charging, you know, hundreds of dollars a shot for insulin, maybe they should.
All right. Well, we will hopefully be able to revisit that.
Oh, we'll definitely circle around to it. Yeah, because it's a lot of great provisions in that bill.
All right. Okay. Well, that's all the time we got for this week. But
all right. And I want to say congratulations to John Deere workers. That strike is now over. They ratified a new contract this week.
Woohoo.
Collective action works. That's our good news for the week.